You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of December 23rd, 2020, and it's our Game of the Year cast. Da 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 da.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Albor.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And these are the apex video games of the year.
The best ones. The culmination of everything we've loved.
And hated.
Well, that was kind of last week.
That's true, actually. We've boiled away all of the gamies, and we've doled out those awards. This week is a much more focused conversation about our favorite games that were released in 2020.
Yes.
As usual, we play way more games than we could possibly go through in a reasonable fashion, so we pick our top three. And we will discuss each one of those top threes. I guess we'll warn people if there's spoilers for some of them, but you know, we will discuss a little bit about why they ranked up in our top three, and then we will see how we compare. Do you have any predictions as to how we will compare this year?
I believe that you and I will have exactly two games overlap.
That's what I was going to say.
This is my favorite part of every year, of like guessing what games overlap. Here's what I'll say. I think that the conversation that we'll have next week about leftovers is also going to be very interesting, because I think there's a lot of interesting games that came out this year that didn't quite break through the chatter, but I think helped us get through the year in a better state, considering all what are the debacle this particular year has been.
Right.
I also think that of these games, you know, I was making my decision about which three I would pick literally moments before this podcast.
I heard the final deliberation.
Because there's some, you know, there's some that just don't quite, you know, for one reason or another, they shine, but I don't know. We'll see. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it, of course.
So do you want to kick us off then?
Your first sure. Game? I can kick us off with a game that I don't think that you have played yet, but is my number three game of the year, and that is Spider-Man Miles Morales.
Oh,
every
yeah.
time I think I got this Spider-Man thing figured out, something goes wrong.
Miles, our family doesn't give up.
Whenever you say Spider-Man, you always mean the other one. You're Spider-Man. You can fix this. Your way.
This is my time. I'm seizing the moment because I gotta go for the time.
Miles Morales, what a feel good story for the new console launch. I feel like it's one of the few feel good stories for the new console launches.
100% agreed. And in a year where you and I have said many times on the podcast that we are in desperate need of shorter video games, lo and behold, we get a shorter video game. And I think a lot of people have complained that there's a lack of content in this game, that it feels like a piece of DLC. I disagree with that. And even if I could see that point, I still think that there's something to say for purchasing a large, expansive, single-player piece of DLC for a slightly cheaper value and getting a lot of enjoyment out of it. And I think Spider-Man delivers on that. Miles Morales is... I love Spider-Man as a character. He is my favorite superhero, probably always has been. Miles Morales is an awesome entry to the series. The animated Spider-Man with Miles Morales was an absolute hit. I loved that film. And playing as Miles Morales now, especially as a younger self, you get to experience a little bit more of what that coming of age experience is for Peter Parker that made him the original Spider-Man, right? A lot of people fell in love with Peter Parker in his high school years when he was fumbling through being Spider-Man and couldn't quite figure it out. And this is a great version of that kind of Spider-Man. But it's also one that's much more diverse. Like, you were in You're in New York again, but you're really focused on Harlem. You're really focused on the Puerto Rican community and the Black community there, and the Afro-Latinx community, as Miles is a member of.
Yep.
And to be able to see that in a AAA game is just really rewarding, really validating.
I was going to ask about that, actually. How much do you... How much do you interact with Miles without the mask? Like, is this something
all the time.
That... Yeah. Oh, man, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, too, is... And again, I won't spoil anything from Spider-Man, but it is a game that really focuses on the family and the characters that are around Spider-Man. Like, you know, people joke because Miles is really bad at keeping his secret identity a secret. Like, Genki knows, and, you know, all these people around him know that he is, in fact, this new Spider-Man. And... that's okay because it allows them to then focus on the relationships between everybody within that circle.
Yeah.
And I was genuinely moved by the story in a way that the first Spider-Man didn't accomplish. I think the first Spider-Man was very, very good and I love it to death. But I think between this and the last Spider-Man, I think I prefer Miles Morales. And one of the reasons is because the story is genuinely touching. And, you know, during those last sequences, I was getting like emotionally worked up over the superhero story in all of the great ways that you should from a very compelling, well-told superhero story. And all of that is to say nothing of the continuously fantastic game mechanics that Insomniac has put together in the Spider-Man series, including all of the new ones that Miles has at his disposal. It feels fucking great being Spider-Man, and there's very little time spent in that game where I'm not grinning ear to ear at how much I'm just enjoying the moment-to-moment experience.
That's awesome. I mean, and it, in a weird way, this is coming back to something that we had. You know, it's coming back to meaningful DLC packs, you know, whether it's the... what was the GTA one? The Ballad of Gay Tony. And
Ballad of Gay
there's
Tony,
one other...
Well, and Insomniac,
The Last of Us had a couple really strong ones.
Yeah,
I really like this trend, you know?
And Insomniac was one of the first when they released, Infamous First Light?
Yeah, yeah.
Which was very good, and I really enjoyed that game quite a bit. This feels like that. And honestly, man, I liked First Light better than Infamous as well. So... if I could just exclusively play all of Insomniac's smaller games, I think I would have a better time, generally speaking. And I think if more creators were willing to do that, to release these like longer story-driven exploratory games within the mechanics or within the systems that they've already developed on a larger title, I think we'll be better off, especially if people just stop complaining about it.
Well, because it gives them space to then do something interesting with the story alongside the mechanics, like it sounds like they did with Miles Morales.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, that's really, I know we're going on about this, but it's just, it's really rewarding to hear that story about Miles specifically as good, because that's always been a strength of the Spider-Man character in general, where you could have many different Spider-Men and women and anyone could see themselves in. Even when he was still a white guy in the 60s or whatever, he was wearing a mask, so you could kind of see yourself in him no matter who you were. And just them leaning into that, especially after the Spider-Verse movie, is awesome. Because they didn't have to do that. They could have just put out another Spider-Man thing and it would have been fine. You know?
Well, and it's, you know, it's the idea that anyone could be a superhero or a hero, not because anyone is just this bland person, that our characters are not without life and without, you know, vigor and without family connections. You know, Miles is a very particular person, but he is, you know, he is likable. You can relate to him in so many different ways. And I think that's the hallmark of a great superhero.
I feel like that means that Spider-Man and Miles Morales, they've both appeared on your Game of the Year list.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
Like, what a platform this is becoming.
And what I am so excited by is last year, I guess the year before, when we were talking about Spider-Man, my dream was for one day this game to have online multiplayer. And now that Miles is well and truly Spider-Man, and we still have a world with Peter Parker, I think this game is setting up an opportunity for me to have my two-player Spider-Man co-op, where we're, swinging through the cities, and now there's new abilities where like we can tag team things together. Like, there's so many exciting opportunities that I cannot wait for them to continue that series.
That's awesome. Well, well deserved, Spider-Man Miles Morales.
Good job, Miles. All right, what's your number three game of the year?
So I'll preface this entire game of the year discussion by saying that I think secretly this was actually a very strong year for video games.
Yeah.
And this was the easiest pick probably in a long time for my game of the year. All three of them was like boom, boom, boom.
Oh, wow.
All three of them. Like, sweet. Very fast.
Yeah.
And this one is the in other years, this third game may have been even higher than three. But the first game that I'll call out is Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Tonight marks a new beginning
for Shinra.
This could well be her last line of defense.
Let's go.
Let us defy destiny together. Cloud, there's still so much to be done.
Very nice. Very nice. So I will just point out now, Final Fantasy VII Remake is my number two game of the year.
Hey! Wow, number two. What the hell?
What a shocker.
Scott. Yeah.
Like, I never thought in a million years Final Fantasy Remake would be number two or on my list at all.
I'm pretty sure both of us at one time or another had actively said we were dreading this game.
Yeah, 100%. Yep. Well, go ahead. Tell me why it stands out for you.
So I think part of it is the meta commentary, you know, the meta achievement of what this mm-hmm. game was, which is truly a remake of Final Fantasy VII with the same characters, but telling a different story that if you don't even have to read that far into it to see that they are confronting the first game head on and saying, what you think you know about this universe, we're just going to change it. And we know some people aren't going to like it, and they're going to try to draw us back to the normal one. But guess what? We're not going to do it. So come along or not. And I was like, man, you do not get that sort of we are living in an age of fan service. And for this game to come out and just directly rebuke key aspects of the first Final Fantasy VII is wild, especially with the type of audience that they're dealing with.
And so a lot of people are calling it a requel.
It kind of is. I mean, especially where that game ends is I have no clue where they're going to go with it. And so I really admire them because they could have just done a complete shot for shot anime remake, basically. And they didn't. And then on top of that, the game is great. The battle system is amazing. The game looks excellent. The voice acting is extremely solid and downright good in many places. It's just a really cool achievement. And to see them, how long have they been working on this game? I feel like this game and Cyberpunk were basically announced at the same time.
Yeah.
And they stuck it on every level. They stuck the landing. And it was just an incredible surprise and something that I never thought that this would be one of our top games.
100% agreed. I think you hit the nail on the head in how much of a achievement it is to really walk what is a very, very challenging line between being true to the original, and not just true in a narrative sense, but true in a mechanical sense. Like, it has to feel like an RPG. It has to feel like customization. Key world elements have to be there, even ones that you and I talked shit about, like the amount of mini games or one-off mechanics that exist in the Final Fantasy VII original. And on top of that, you know, to still deliver in a way where people aren't going to be mad that this is only one part of a much larger original game, right? Yeah. There was some flack that they received when it was shared that this game would be broken up into, I think, three parts is at what they announced. For the Final Fantasy VII Remake series, right? Yeah. To walk that line and still meet all of those demands is incredible. Like, you know, the mechanics do feel like an RPG.
Yep.
Each of the characters do feel specialized, but just like in the original, you can really customize and move them and use them how you see fit. There's something that feels so good and shows such finesse as you are swapping between characters and each of them are interacting with a boss. And then the moment you run out of EP or, ability points, you switch over to another character and now you're in their combat and you're engaging in things in a little different way. If you're Barrett, you could be suddenly, you know, many yards away from an enemy that you were just in melee range in the air, and the characters will continue to fight in a sort of ballet-like movement on the battlefield. And then, like you said, from a story perspective, not just to still have these characters, but enrich them in a way that is so much more meaningful than was originally provided, and then to throw all the rules out the window, you know, to bring back characters that we thought we would never see, to seed things earlier shows a certain respect as well to how the audience of Final Fantasy VII has matured and has both new expectations and new opportunities to upset those expectations. It is a phenomenal achievement. Yeah. And I was talking to someone about this a while back, and they said, and I both love and hate this comment, and you'll see why, but they said, this is your Kingdom Hearts for Final Fantasy fans, right? This is the game that is bringing in all of these different worldly pieces and doing it in one beautiful package.
Yeah.
And while I'll never understand Kingdom Hearts, I gotta love that comment. I think this feels like a crowning success. Yeah. And it's just a remarkable thing to watch. And I'm thrilled about how they might approach the next game, especially now that we know that, you know, anything goes. Like, it really could be totally surprising.
Well, they did... It's so rare for something to earn all of its twists and turns and to earn some of its departure from the original, but because they just do such a great job of paying homage to the first game. You know, you go through the Sector 7 slums, you do the Don Corneo stuff, you do all that stuff, but then they get to add new things in there. There's these, like, you know, weird shadowy characters. There's new, fully new voiced characters that aren't there. And then that lets them say, all right, we've proven to you that we understand what made this first game special. And now we're going to depart from what you know about it. And you can now be confident in us that we understand what it takes to create a world, and now we're going to open it up so that you don't know what's coming next, which is super exciting.
I think the way that you just described it, this is what I wanted out of the Star Wars franchise.
Yes.
That we never got, right? Yeah. Because time and again, outside of maybe Mandalorian a little bit, because I think Dave Filoni, who worked on the Clone Wars, understands very well why people love Star Wars.
Right.
The new films fail to understand that. I really love the Rian Johnson film. I think maybe that's an outlier, and I know some people hate it. But
it's a good movie, not because it's a Star Wars movie, though. It's like, if you strip Star Wars out of it, that would just be an interesting non-traditional sci-fi opera. But like,
and despite the fact that I like that film too, the series as a whole never knew where it was going, and the films don't speak to one another. They don't resonate with one another. They almost seem to attack one another.
Yeah.
They throw core ideas from the original out the window, and then
the characters don't even act like themselves. So it's like, what is even going on here? And like, it's just very strange.
You know, I'm not normally someone that says, wow, like, you should really learn from video games when it comes to like storytelling and world building. But look, like, fucking play Final Fantasy VII Remake if you want to know how to really tackle an IP that is so meaningful to so many people, but not make it feel stale and trite. And look, I like The Mandalorian, but even that feels like so many nods to existing franchises without substance at times.
Yeah.
And I think Final Fantasy VII, they only do that. They only dip into that occasionally, and they know their limit, and they provide, I think, generally speaking, something that feels new and fresh and original.
It was, when I was thinking about it, in terms of the Star Wars thing, and also in terms of Avatar: The Last Airbender, where they, for the life of them, they keep on fucking remaking Avatar: The Last Airbender, but you know, they really whiffed it on the film, and the creators walked away from the TV show, and so it's like, again, they are probably failing where Final Fantasy VII wildly succeeded, and it was because they knew when to depart and what to include and earn the respect back from the player and the audience. And also, they just made a damn good game. Like, that it's one of the better RPGs I played in a really long time, and it's just fun to play. I did every single side mission in that game.
Yep. Agreed. Okay, well, that was your number three game.
That was my number three. And so that was your number two?
My number two game of the year. Oh, yeah. Man. So then.
Should I go back to my number two?
Yeah, what's your number two?
Okay, my number two, Spelunky 2.
Okay, very good. So this is the one that just didn't make my list. Well, one of a couple that just didn't make my list.
Man, I mean, I can fully understand why, because I have, even more so than Spelunky 1, I have a love-hate off-and-on relationship with Spelunky 2 because it's just so punishing.
It is, yes, yeah.
It's ridiculously punishing, like in a way that I was not expecting nor prepared for.
Well, and I don't think that this game stands alone as well as the first game.
Yes.
Because I think it is so much more accessible if you are familiar with the original.
Yes. I was telling it to Hannah exactly, because as she was sitting there on the couch and I was like swearing at the TV, she was like, "You must really love this game, huh?" In like a joking way. But it's like, I do, yeah. But it's, and then I was like, it's so rare for a developer. Derek Yu made this game for Spelunky superfans. Like, anyone coming to this game fresh is going to be 100% lost. Like, I wouldn't even recommend someone play this before playing Spelunky 1.
Yeah, agreed. 100% agreed. And in fact, I would say don't play this until you feel comfortable in Spelunky 1.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Until you feel like very well versed in it, because and I feel like usually it's the opposite way in video games. And in video games, every sequel gets more accessible. You know, every sequel is meant to draw in a broader audience, but this sequel narrows the audience. It's, if you loved Spelunky and truly loved Spelunky, then you will also truly love this game. But it will be an even greater challenge, because we know you're good. If you love Spelunky that much, you're probably pretty good at it. And so Derek, you then raises the bar for how good you have to be at this game.
And again,
the number of secrets, the number of little hidden mechanics that are there, it ratchets up every single portion of that first game, which I obviously love, but I can definitely see it also, it's a double-edged sword for sure. You know, this game is far more controversial than the first game, because it is so much, it feels, you know what it actually is, and I didn't even think about this, but it's fitting because of how Spelunky borrows from it. In Super Mario Brothers 2, which in the United States was Super Mario Brothers The Lost Levels, was the same exact engine and everything as Super Mario Brothers 1, but just way harder. You know, there was like crazy, like single block jumps, and enemies did different things, and that's what Spelunky 2 feels like. It's exactly like Spelunky 1, except that they ratcheted everything up under the assumption that mostly the super fans are going to be playing it.
Yeah, 100%. Especially that first level. It's like he really wants you to know this is not Spelunky 1.
It's a statement.
Are you aware of that? Have you died a million times from a fucking gopher yet? Okay, it's not Spelunky 1. Yeah, and you know, and all of those things are 100% spot on. I was playing this yesterday, partially because I was in contention for my game of the year. And, you know, there were a couple of things that were a little bit irritating. Like, you know, when I activate the drill, there's a chance that there's a shopkeep in there and I piss them off. Or, you know, like it is, I can less reliably kill them, or the reward of that is less reliable, which is maybe okay. Maybe I'm just not good enough yet to really accomplish that. The online co-op is basically non-functioning. That was another reason it didn't really make my list. Because I was really hoping that the netcode would be good.
Yeah.
Because I love playing this game co-op.
Yep.
And COVID-19 means there's no such thing as couch co-op right now.
Yeah.
And online co-op is unserviceable in Spelunky.
That was something that was really, like, I was actually thinking about that exact thing the other day, where I was like, man, I really wish I could be sitting next to George playing this game right now.
Oh, it would be so fun, dude. Oh my God, it'd be so fun. But see, like, all of those things said, right? I still go back to it all the time. I've played it basically every day for the past 2 weeks. Rather than playing Cyberpunk, I will very frequently just opt to play Spelunky 2 instead.
Yeah.
Because of the frequency of how much I die, I know that when I go into a run, I'll generally know if my run will be okay within a given period of time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so it's either I have a 15-minute run or I have a 40-minute run. Right. And I do really well, you know? And there's enough to do in terms of the optional side pieces that there's so many challenges that I can choose to partake if I want to, right? I always get the Dracula wings, for example. Mm-hmm. And that gets me killed a handful of times. But man, I've gotten better at doing that one thing.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm probably better at it than a lot of other people who never try that thing.
Yeah.
And now that I do that consistently, well, maybe my next challenge is going to be the City of Gold, you know?
Yeah.
Or even now, I've only ever been into the jungle level like a dozen times because it's just not my preferred route. But there's a whole world I can go explore.
That's, you know? You gotta get your black market run down, because that's what I've been working on lately.
Yeah, maybe I should opt to that. But I mean, that is what's so exciting, right? Is because Spelunky 1 is a game that I could play forever, and Spelunky 2, despite those criticisms, also feels like a game I could play forever.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We spent a lot of time on how brutal the game is, and it is. But there's also, we said this during our debrief, where this game is this game fulfills the Orwell's rules of games in so many ways. You know, it's just an exquisitely elegant game in terms of how all the mechanics fit together. And you know, every time I fail because I wasn't thinking straight, I was like, oh right, of course, if I were to shoot that would explode and fling that rock, which would then hit me off into that spikes, like, that's my fault, you know. That's why the game is so enraging, because the rules are so elegant that you can certainly predict what's going to happen most of the time if you just are willing to think about it. And there's just something just masterful about, you know this is peak Spelunky. And that's both like the praise and the criticism, which is, the criticism is, this is, there's nowhere to go. Once you've made the perfect game, there's nowhere to go but sideways. And this is an exquisite step sideways.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. In multiple side rooms with branching passageways full of death traps.
And I just want to unlock all the characters and do all that stuff. It's, you know, it will be, like the first game, it will be a consistent kind of meditative thing. And, you know, now that they announced both games for the Nintendo Switch next year, it will just follow me around wherever I go.
Yeah. Well, I should say, I already own Spelunky 2 on both PlayStation 5 and PC.
Right. So,
makes sense. Makes perfect sense.
Oh, man. Okay, well, that brings us to our number one. You want to go first?
Sure. Although, I think it's the same game. So that game is Hades.
Hey, me too.
Time for the main event.
Stupid boy. I told you nobody gets out of here.
Yes, carry on, everyone. Don't mind me.
Man, I am over the moon that Supergiant didn't just return to form following Pyre, which both you and I disliked. But this game really feels like a culmination of everything that they've worked on over the years.
Yep.
Every decision that you can make is a valid one. And not just a valid one, but one that you are really encouraged to make.
Yeah.
And rewarded for making, right? You know, I've probably done, I don't know, near 100 runs of Hades at this point. And a lot of the runs are with one or two particular weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then I say, fuck it, I'm going to mix it up. I'm going to use the spear this time.
Yeah.
And that run is just as valid as well. You know, like, it is a masterpiece in the way that they can fill a game with so much content narratively and especially mechanically, and not make it feel bloated, not make it feel like it is, like there are things that are unnecessary or loose, you know? I think that it is one of the most accessible roguelikes out there right now.
Yep.
For people who are interested in roguelikes, because there's so many rewarding aspects to every playthrough, both mechanically and narratively speaking. And from a story perspective, I think this is probably the best accomplishment in narrative storytelling melding with the mechanics in ludonarrative resonance, if you will, from this past year.
Oh yeah,
if not over the past 5 years.
It's in a roguelike, which is notoriously hard to have a cohesive story in because of its looping quality, and they take that explicitly and make a game around a looping story, which is genius. You know, it's genius in its simplicity. I've played so much of it. I shudder to think of the amount of hours I spent on this game this year. I've done probably close to 200 runs.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I played a lot of this game, and
In a weird way, like, I kind of wish I still had a commute to work, because this would be my go-to all the time.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, I can't, you know, again, kind of like what you were saying about Spelunky, like, when I was like, maybe I should keep playing Cyberpunk. And I was like, well, but I did leave off in Asphodel inside of Hades. Like, I could probably just jump right back in.
and even from that perspective, like, there's so many fun little story elements that you're rewarded with on every playthrough. And a lot of the best ones come after you see the credits. It totally comes after the game. I mean, it has some of the best, like, post-game content of any game I've ever played.
I got to a little story bit where Ares, the god of war, was like telling Zagreus to relay to Nyx that he basically has a crush on Nyx.
Whoa.
And I was like, well, who doesn't, Dama, right? I mean, it's like, yeah, can't fault you there, my friend. But also, like, what a crazy, just tiny little side story that you probably wouldn't get until you keep playing the game and go through all the things. But, like, I'm close to 200 runs in and still seeing new little narrative hooks that are coming in. Yep. You grow with the game. I started using different boons that I didn't think that I was good at, but now I've switched over to them, and now I understand how they work, and they're totally valid within certain builds. And it just, everything in that game makes so much sense. And every time you think you found the most OP build, you find a different one that works just as well. And, like, it's just so impressive. And now it's just a deadly game, because I've gotten to the point where my successful runs are between 20 and 30 minutes. And so it's like, oh yeah, I could do another run. I could do another run. And then it's, and then it's 2 a.m, you know? And then it's like, well, geez, you know?
Yeah. The other thing that I find so interesting about this game is Greek mythology, generally speaking, I think is pretty trite. Like, most games, it's just not that fun or interesting to me. And even of all of the things that I love about Hades, that would probably be the first thing I would change, is just the Greek mythology setting. But that being said, I think they do it really well by leaning so heavily into the humor of it, right? Yeah. Like, all of Zagreus' extended family are kind of assholes, and they all embody the thing that they are, right? Like, in a way that some, you know, tabletop RPGs, their deities embody these things, right? Yeah. Like, the god of war is kind of aggressive, and, you know, his mother is a certain way, and his father's a certain way, and, you know, Achilles is a certain way, and all of these different gods talk to one another. You know, every time that you pick up a boon from a deity in a room where there are two boons, the other god is pissed at you, and then they come right back and go, oh, sorry about that. We'll just forget that time I tried to kill you, right? And move on. And that humor works so well for Greek mythology.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked by how much I enjoyed just the narrative tidbits that you get from some of these deities.
Right.
And of course the people, you know, who are in the, I don't know, the little, like, hotel de hell, I guess, where you're staying, right?
The, like, house of Hades.
Right. Like, Meg is there and she's great, but Dusa or Thanatos or the folks that are in their room, and they'll talk to one another as well, and you'll overhear the conversations and you'll get more little tidbits about the world that you inhabit. And despite the space being quite confined, it feels expansive.
Yeah. I mean, I went back and played some Supergiant games just to kind of see their trajectory. And I said this during our debrief, but even after playing all of those, it's just so impressive to see them meld their games together. Even with Pyre, they even took things from Pyre and put it into this game, but just perfected it in this game. Yeah. And and to see where
the story stuff in particular.
Exactly. The story stuff and even the artwork, like the density of their artwork has gotten so, it's almost like eating a cake that's too delicious. You know, like it's so sweet, you know, that there's so many layers and so much color and so much like minute detail in this game that it's just, there's just so much in this game. Going back to the ancient Greek thing, one of the other things that I liked a lot too was I think you're right. It is hard to do ancient Greece in a way that is novel because that shit's been around for thousands of years now. You know, like we have been telling stories about Zeus for literally thousands of years. But I think it was cool, kind of similar actually to the Miles Morales thing. It's cool to think about the Greek world in a broader way than basically a bunch of British people in togas, you know, which is generally speaking how people conceive of the Greek world. But then if you think about it, like, you know, it was a thriving, it was in the center of a area in Europe where you could get to the Middle East, you could get to Africa, you could even get to Asia if you were smart enough and can get past all that stuff. So like it was a diverse place and people worship different gods in different ways and in different regions. So, you know, not everyone's Ares was probably the same, even in looks, you know? Yeah. And so I really liked the liberty with which they approached how this game approaches the pantheon. Whether it's just having Greek gods that have a diverse lineup or having, you know, a bunch of different, you know, personalities in them that aren't just kind of like a stuffy British version of how Greek gods go. Like I enjoyed how they were able to just kind of open up and probably do something that was a little bit closer to the real world than what we kind of usually conceive of as, you know, Greek mythology.
Yeah. I think that I forget what channel, there's a documentary series about Supergiant as they develop Hades.
Oh, cool.
Which I would love to watch sometime. I've never seen it myself. I've only like seen a couple of trailers for it. But, you know, I'm just fascinated by the challenges that a company like this faces, right? They're a very lean, small group of individuals who are making these games.
Yep.
And yet the games feel extremely rich, as you pointed out, right? Like a fancy slice of cake. And I just sometimes I don't know how they do it, you know, like I just genuinely don't understand how does every little piece feel so polished, you know?
Right.
How does it feel as though they've cut the chaff despite being so full?
Right.
And I think there's this constant refinement that they must go through to really, you know, sharpen and polish this into the gem that it is.
Yeah.
And we see companies of greater size with more experience, with more games under their belt, get flustered and are unable to figure it out. You know, they can't figure out what is fun about this experience. How do we polish it together? You know, how do we make it into something cohesive? That was our biggest flaw or biggest failing we found in Pyre.
Yep.
And one of my fears around Pyre was maybe Bastion and Transistor were, in a way, dumb luck. You know, maybe...
Right.
This is their, you know how people throw a lot of shade at Pixar for coming up with a few really great ideas and then just riding that gravy train all the way to the bank and floundering, you know, like we have a new, the Origins of Buzz Lightyear is coming out now, right? Because we can't get away from Toy Story. That's all that they're good at. Supergiant never released a Bastion 2. They never released a Transistor 2. You know, every single one of these games have been brand new. And while they've built on the expertise and experiences that they've developed as a studio, it doesn't feel like they're necessarily treading old ground or that they're just spinning their wheels. And it is really encouraging to see something like Pyre, where I think that was underwhelming, and I think from a sales perspective it was underwhelming, still feed into what is making this game so successful. Because it's not just, you know, it's not just the story of Hades itself that's so rewarding and inspiring when we're talking about or thinking about Hades. Yep. It's the story of just Supergiant as a whole, you know, as a team that has managed to remain quite a bit independent, come out with games that for a lot of people are the best games that they've played of all time. You know, they've made four games and three of them are some of the best games I have ever played.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the type of story you want to tell people, right? That's the myth that you want to talk about when you talk about what makes a game company strong. And they do it without being a company that relies on exploitation and crunch,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you got to wonder, like, I mean, obviously there's, you never know what to believe, but the stories have been out there so often that the studio doesn't really crunch and the studio has, you know, a generous vacation time, and the studio takes a long time in between games too. Like they're not cranking something out every year. And they stay small and the results speak for themselves. And it's like, oh, well, maybe everyone can just kind of learn a little bit something from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is very much the, you know, this is the statue. This is the golden child that you put upon a pedestal, right, for an independent game studio doing things right, you know?
One of the other things about Hades that I really liked, and this is, I think maybe this speaks to some of the success of Supergiant, is that they almost operate, it seems like they're operating more like a, almost like a theater troupe, you know, because it's the same people every time, whether it's, you know, Kasavin and Rao kind of helming everything, you know, the artists, the musicians, the voice actors, they've been the same through all the games. And you start to kind of, it's like a, you know, it's like watching a Wes Anderson movie or something where it's like, oh yeah, like I know this cast of characters. Let's see what they have to do this time around. You know, there's a certain familiarity with Supergiant, and I feel like it must help the studio to have that sort of cohesion and continuity over what, like Bastion came out like 10 years ago or something. So like there's very few people that can keep friends for 10 years, let alone a game studio together.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's also something to where this group of people is only getting better at what they're doing. And it seems like they, in many ways, they're kind of trusting each other a little bit more. And, you know, they're able to put more and more into each game, which I think is pretty special. And I think it comes through a lot in Hades because it's such a combination of what all of those people are good at, you know, all in one game.
Yeah. I think sometimes we talk about those moments in games where you can tell that someone just really cared about particular things. So much of what makes Hades strong are these tiny little elements, right? Yep. The massive list of ways that you can make the game more challenging for yourself once you've seen the credits roll. Each one of those someone thought about, playtested, polished, thought about in relationship to some of the other things. You know, really crunched some time that goes into making sure that it's not a disaster, you know? And I know that I think early access helped them a lot.
Yeah.
I touched it very, very briefly and then never went back because I wanted to keep it safe for me.
Right.
But from everything that I've heard, they took a lot of really positive feedback from that experience.
Yep.
And to know that type of work, that type of care is just felt in some of the small things that they deliver in the final product, it fills you with warm fuzzies when you play, right?
Yeah.
And even in the tiny pieces of dialogue that someone wrote, and most people will never see.
Exactly.
It gives you a little warm fuzzies, you know, when you see that. And so, you know, I'm not surprised Hades is our number one game of the year. I think after we played this game and we were praising it on our debrief,
right,
it was pretty clear that this was going to be a standout game of the year. I know it's on a lot of other people's lists as well. And it feels like, even though it's a roguelike, even though it's punishing and challenging, and it's not the type of game a lot of people I think would normally play, it feels like a happy end to the year,
totally,
at least in the game space, you know?
Yeah.
Cyberpunk aside, this is kind of the game that I think we really needed this year.
Yeah, the most comforting vision of hell that one could ever interact with.
Yeah. And what's surprising too is it's still only on the Switch and PC. It's still not on PlayStation 5 for Xbox.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a long tail on this game for a lot of people. You know, Hades is quickly entering Hades quickly entered the pantheon of games like Spelunky and Binding of Isaac and FTL and like all of those types of games where I could essentially play them endlessly. And I think that's going to be, I think that this game is going to be pretty much a perennial thing for a lot of people, including myself.
Do you think that this is Supergiant's best game?
Yeah, unequivocally, this is their best game. I agree with you that I actually like the story of Bastion the best, because I think it's it's a cool creative story, and I think the world is very cool and compelling, but the combination of what they do with the characters and the gameplay, I think this is easily their best game, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now let's get like a fighting game from them where I can bring all of the characters from the different games to each other.
Super Giant, Super Smash.
Oh, sign me up. That'd be so cool. And with the wild thing too, right? If you heard Super Giant's making a fighting game, I feel like you and I would go, that's probably going to be great.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, they have such a talent for minute systems in games and how they can all work together. I mean, it does not surprise me whatsoever that a lot of the people, I don't know if they still play it, but a lot of the people at that studio logged a lot of time in Dota.
Yeah.
You know, like the tiny details of that game suggest that there are people watching very carefully about what makes for a balanced and fun game. And it's just so pleasing to play a game with that much care and attention and, you know, good spirit put into it.
Yeah.
There it is. There's a, like I said, I think it was, and we will go into more games in the Leftovers show. That's because right, I think there's a lot of strong games, like for you, like for Spelunky 2, that didn't quite make the list, but it's just because there were so many other strong games that were there. Like, it wasn't one of those things where like, well, I have to scrape to find something.
There's also a couple games that didn't come out this year.
Yeah.
That, not just me, but a lot of people discovered this year
that
I think are very worth talking about, because it is this weird confluence of events where people are staying inside and finding ways to entertain themselves in video games, sometimes solo and sometimes together. And I think that changes what, you know, what is going to satisfy the appetite of players at home.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, I guess we will leave it there. Like I said, we're going to keep rolling with our end of the year stuff. Next week, we'll talk about some of the games that did not make these top three, which should be a pretty interesting combo of games. Yes. There's a lot of stuff there.
Yes, indeed.
All right. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is the website. You can also find us wherever you find podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. You know where to look.
Cool. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Ciao and happy holidays. There's a place you go to, because I